You know, last night was a remarkable night for the Ottawa Senators. They win again. Andrew Hammond wins again, 14-0-1. They're rocking and rolling. They're now in a playoff spot. They got the wild card. The Bruins are slipping. We're going to talk to Joe Haggerty about that in a couple seconds. It's a whole thing. It's a very exciting time if you're an Ottawa Senators fan. And last night's game was exhilarating. All those goals in the third period. Your boy Hammond doing his thing again. Burgers on the ice. It was a grand old time. And it wouldn't surprise any of us to see them go all the way here. Secure that wild card spot. They control their own destiny, as it's called. And end up as a playoff team. Be very exciting. Although, don't sleep on the Cats. Florida's got a game against Ottawa and two against Boston, so don't sleep on the Cats. But in every game in which there is a winner, ladies and gentlemen, there must also be a loser. Which brings us to the San Jose Sharks. Try as they might, the Sharks fell short last night. They did everything they could. Took a run at Hammond with Logan Couture. Couldn't knock him out of the game. And they fell short. And right now, the Sharks' playoff chances, the percentage that they will make the playoffs, is under 1% in the Western Conference. It is time, ladies and gentlemen, to start looking forward. It is time, ladies and gentlemen, to start figuring out what the Sharks are going to do this offseason. Not coincidentally, that is also the question of the day. Joe Pack has a side QOD that I'll get to later. Kent Coons, name a captain. Adam Herman, apologize. Austin Burns, win the lottery. Oh boy, that'd be a giant F you to the world, wouldn't it? The first time since the Jurassic era when the Sharks missed the playoffs and then they win the McDavid lottery. Oof. Jason Prinzi writes in, considering it will start April 12th, I would say dismiss the GM and maybe the coach. They have to start fresh and new. Ken Bockelman, get real hockey sweaters under this practice jersey, numbers in the front bullshit. Yeah, I was looking at their white jerseys last night watching the game against the Senators, and they are atrocious. Braden T. Fire Wilson and McClellan. Move Burns to forward. Try to trade a 2016 second for Reimer. Trade Pavelski and Thornton for big returns. It's a lot of stuff. James McBee, make Thornton and Wilson attend a team-building seminar heavy on rope ladders and trust falls. A lot of extend John Scott's, including one from our good buddy Ryan Lambert. And that is an amazing thought. Annie Santoro is a Sharks fan, writes in, scorched earth through hockey ops. Maybe keep the scouting staff and Robinson as development coach. Otherwise, everyone out of the pool. I don't know if they're going to cut that deep. I was trying to figure out as I was watching the last throws of the San Jose Sharks season last night what my approach to them would be, what I would do to try to figure this mess out. You come back to a basic problem, which is that unless one or both of those building blocks, Thornton and Marleau, decide they want to go, you're stuck with them. And you can get super aggressive and demote them and whatever, but like the bottom line is that they love playing where they're playing. They love living where they're living. So we could talk about strong arm tactics, but is that really at the end of the day the best thing for the club? You already created a schism on the team with the way you've treated the veteran guys. The players in that room hate Doug Wilson. So do you really want to play more hardball? It's a real tough situation because here's the thing. You get the sense that they believe McClellan is a real good coach. And you get the sense that if push came to shove, they'd rather not get rid of him. Because you get the sense that at the minute he hits the open market, he's in Toronto. He is signed, sealed, and delivered if they can't get Babcock there. So somebody else would grab him in a millisecond. Why would you want to get rid of him? The Doug Wilson thing would be a sea change for the organization. I think the right move might be fire the GM, keep the coach, to be honest with you. I don't think McClellan's the problem there, do you? I know that would be revolutionary, and I know inevitably if you bring in a GM, you're probably looking at the coach being out there in the next 1 or 2 years anyway, because GMs always like to bring in their own guys. But the idea that McClellan's the problem is something I can't fly with. The idea that Wilson's the problem is something I can get behind, because he's made a hash of it. Didn't address the issues that they had last season. Didn't address the problems that they had in that lineup. And ultimately, at a critical point in the season, created this nonsensical controversy with Thornton. A ridiculous distraction. Steve writes in, fire Doug Wilson, ask Marlowe to waive no trade clause, bring in a number one D-man, move Burns to forward just to start. Yeah, well, easier said than done. Easier said than done. Joining us down the line is a guy who is also going to be probably covering a interesting offseason, in theory, if things don't go their way. But let's not count him out quite yet. He is Joe Haggerty. He joins us here on the Merrick vs. Brzezinski podcast to talk about the Boston Bruins, currently inhabiting the ninth spot in the Eastern Conference behind the Ottawa Senators. Hags, how you doing?
What's up, Wish You Zamboni Pony? What's going on, my friend?
Zamboni Pony, the name that never was for Puck Daddy. Joe Haggerty dropping the inside knowledge.
Totally as you may, baseball right there.
As you, may know, Hags, the reason that Zamboni Pony was not adopted by my former boss, Jamie Mottram and Yahoo, is because I convinced them that it was a trademark violation. And that may not even be true. But the idea of going on radio stations across this great continent of ours and being called the Zamboni Pony was frightening to me and made my stomach gurgle with fear. So yeah. I'm happy
I can understand the trepidation, you know? Puck Daddy's got a much nicer ring to it, there's no question.
It does, but at the end of the day I still get confused. You know, when somebody says Puck Daddy is a bastion of misogyny and protecting sexual harassers, I don't know if they're talking about me or the blog, because some people can't read bylines. Anyway, Hags, about the Bruins.
They need to clarify.
They really need to clarify it. Yeah, they do. Hags, the Bruins are on the outside looking in, and we're all worried about them now. The Senators control their own destiny. Bad news today also with the loss of Dougie Hamilton for a bit. Is there any hope that the Bruins can pull this thing out and give us the Habs versus Bruins first-round matchup we all would like to see?
I suppose, I mean, look, until it's 0%, they have a chance, right? That sports club stats site has them at 33% to make the playoffs, and they still have 9 games left. But I got to be honest with you. As soon as that Ottawa game went down last week, where they lost them head-to-head in a real statement game as far as I was concerned, that was it. And I didn't think they were going to make the playoffs once they lost that game. And, you know, in the past, those are the kind of games, and this is the time of year, obviously, when the Bruins find that little extra to not only secure their spot, but also really discourage the teams that are chasing them like that. And, you know, that was the perfect statement game to do something like that against Ottawa, where if you beat them, not only do you help yourself, but you really start to put a little doubt into a team that's starting to feel good about themselves and really starting to believe that they can do it. Instead, Ottawa just takes that game right away in the opening faceoff, scores, and really dictates the pace of that game. It just creates a track meet up and down the ice that the Bruins don't want to engage in, and they did anyway. And they lose the game, and the next thing you know, Ottawa's just flying. And that game for me was, on one side, you've got the Ottawa Senators, who are buoyant, who are having fun, who believe in themselves, and are, you know, the Hamburglar story is great, and everybody's glomming onto that. And on the other side, you've got the Boston Bruins, who are just slogging their way through the end of this season, burdened down by the responsibility of having to make the playoffs, or, you know, all of these consequences are going to be facing them in the offseason. And really, there's just, you know, there's no joy or lightness to what the Bruins are doing right now. And I think that's weighing them down, in addition to, you know, they're dragging some players with them that just aren't giving everything they've got every single night. And hard to win hockey games in March and April when you're doing that.
Who are the guys you're talking about there, as far as not giving everything they got every single night?
Well, I think there's a number of them. You know, Riley Smith was scratched the other night, and has done nothing for a long period of time. He's had three goals since the beginning of January, you know, and he's got one assist since signing that big two-year, big-money deal earlier this month. And, you know, coming off a 20-goal campaign last year, he's going to be nowhere close to that this year. I really think when the intensity has gone up and the pressure's gone up, you haven't seen as much out of Louis Eriksson and Carl Soderberg. Soderberg certainly has been really invisible for the most part lately. He had that goal in Ottawa, but besides that, he hasn't really done much. You know, Milan Lucic has been kind of in and out. He's had some good stretches. He's had some bad stretches. You know, obviously, I think Seidenberg and Chara are giving everything that they have, but they just don't have enough anymore to really get it done. You know, they look so creaky when they play like the second night of a back-to-back or the third game in 4 days, as they did in Tampa the other night, you know, and it was so obvious they just couldn't keep up with what was going on there playing that kind of a game. So, you know, that there was a real genuine feeling, I think, of anger and frustration in that dressing room from some players like Patrice Bergeron and Brad Marchand after that Tampa Bay game. Yeah. Because they're given everything they've got every single night, and they just don't feel like everybody else is going full bore all the time. And Marchand basically said as much after the game was over. And, you know, that's usually a sign of a team that that isn't going to very good places.
Yeah, no kidding. Where does that come from, though? I mean, obviously, at the beginning of the season, we all think that this team still has a window of opportunity. We all think it's a veteran team. People, even when the team was struggling, people were saying the same thing, which is just get them into the dance and see what happens. Because with Bergeron and Krejci and with Rask and all thing, like, it's all there in theory on paper that they were going to be able to challenge this year. So where does this sort of malaise come from? Is it a sense that the window is closed? Is it the sense that we're not at the top of the standings, so we're kind of bummed out about the overall direction of the team? I mean, where does it come from?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think there's definitely, you know, these are players that have been to the mountaintop before, and they know what it takes to win. And, you know, they're looking around and saying to themselves, we just don't have what it takes this year. You know, the statement when you trade Johnny Boychuk right before the season starts is you're basically saying, you know, we're in a transition year. This isn't a year where we're going for it and we're going to try to win the cup. You know, you don't replace Sean Thornton. You don't replace Jerome McGinley. You trade away Johnny Boychuk. And you don't get anything that's going to help you right immediately then. You know, that sends a message, I think, to the rest of those players that, you know, we're not sure that we're winning this year and that we have what it takes. And we're starting to transition into whatever the next phase is. And, you know, for veteran players that want to win now, I think that's a tough message. And even if it's subconsciously, I think it will affect them to some degree as to how much they're willing to sacrifice, how much blood and sweat they're going to spill, you know, how much they're going to be able to dig down deep like they did before when, you know, in pretty much every year past for the Bruins in the last 5 or 6 years, those players legitimately felt like they had a team that could win the cup and could play with anybody and could do anything. And I don't think they had that feeling this year. And you couple that with some players, I think, that are worried, frankly, about where they're going to be next year or where they're going to be the year afterwards and what their place is on the team. And, you know, I think individual interests start to creep in ahead of maybe the, you know, the team goal and the unified sort of front. And once that happens and you've got some players that are very happy and content with huge contracts and long terms and you have other ones who don't know where they're going to be, I think you start to see that uneven, you know, effort level and you start to see cracks developing within a team that used to be airtight. You know, I've covered this team for a long time and I've traveled with them a lot and covered almost every game for a long period of time. And there is such a different feeling around this team this year than there has been in any of the years past. And a lot of that's got to do with the leadership in the room and just the feeling around the team and where they're going this year.
So you bring us to an interesting point about the Bruins now, which is that if you have players that are worried about where they're going to be next year and you have a team that obviously has some cap issues. We saw that before the season with them having a jettison Boychuk when they did, just to kind of put the team that we saw on the ice this season together. How much of this all tracks back to Peter Chiarelli? It seems as though, because of the contracts he's given out, because of the way he's managed his team, they have reached the point of red alert about to explode as far as the cap situation goes. And doesn't that then trickle down to the players and have them worried about the window having closed and worried about this team having to go under a massive overhaul because of the age of the players and the money they have spent committed to this team?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that there's culpability there with Peter Chiarelli. And it goes back to some of the bad drafts that they had leading up to now, when they didn't have enough young players ready to, you know, supplant some of these bottom six forwards and, you know, defensemen that they could have gotten by with guys on entry level deals instead of paying veterans more money than they'd like to. If they had good enough younger players to replace some of these guys, it comes down to, you know, the Tyler Seguin trade. It comes down to signing Jerome Iginla to a big bonus-laden contract last year that basically got them, you know, $4 million plus, almost $5 million in penalties this year that cost you a player like Boychuk. You know, if you didn't have to pay the bonus overage penalties, then you might have been able to keep a player like that. And I think there's, you know, there's definitely fault and culpability with Peter Chiarelli along with everybody else. And I also, you know, would list now at the trade deadline not getting a veteran defenseman when you knew they just finished up a stretch where you're playing 11 games in 18 days and you knew a defenseman was going to go down. It ended up being Dougie Saturday night in Florida. But you knew just by the attrition of playing that many games in that short of time, a guy was going to get hurt. And now you're going to start plugging in young players down the stretch because you didn't trade for a veteran. So, you know, and I think that was another statement that this is a transition year and we're not going to give up draft picks for a year that we don't feel like we have enough to win. And that's the message, whether it's blatant or whether it's a little more subtle coming from up top. So, you know, I think everybody gets some of the blame pie this year for what's going on because it's been a lot less than you thought it was going to be.
Yeah, for sure. So what happens now? I mean, how deep do you think the cuts would go? Now, obviously, you know, we saw at the trade deadline a sign of positive movement, you know, instead of going and trying to dive deep for a veteran guy that was going to be here for a few weeks and give away an asset, they went with a bit of a younger guy, a guy they project to maybe be top six. How deep do you think the cuts would go? And inherently, does management still feel that there are enough pieces here to be a contender, or does there need to be a significant overhaul of the roster?
Yeah, I think when you look at the team, I think there needs to be some changes. You know, you need to every team. They've had a long, glorious run. You know, they've had some excellent years. It's been a highly entertaining team. It's been a highly successful team. This nucleus has done more than people probably thought they were going to, and I think even overachieved to a certain degree. But you know, everything's cyclical in sports, and those kind of teams end up coming to an end at some point. Those core groups, and I think it's at a point now where you really have to start making some hard decisions about players. You know, I said this months and months ago, and people were like trying to storm the castle on me with pitchforks and torches because I mentioned if you start entertaining the thought of trading Zdeno Chara now, and I still think that's something you really have to entertain in the off season, approaching him about his no movement clause and seeing if there are places he'd be willing to go. Because it's pretty clear they need to get younger and faster on defense. That you know, he's aging fairly quickly. He can still play 20 plus minutes. He can still do some very good things. He still has the big shot, but you can't count him every single night to be the player that he was. And I think you could convince another team that he could be a difference maker there for a year or two if it's a team that hasn't been in the playoffs, and he could help give them that boost for the next couple of years. And you could get some value in return for him. But I really think now is the time to think about dealing him and getting some assets back rather than sort of riding off into the sunset with a guy that's got a pretty significant cap hit over the next couple of years. And Milan Lucic, I think, is another player that at this point they have to make a decision on him, whether they're going to give him you know, a huge 6-7 year deal for a lot of money for a player that's taken a lot of physical abuse over the years and plays a very hard physical position and has been very good and has been their, like, prototypical player. But those kind of players, those heavy power forward, big body types, tend to flame out a little faster than other players do, you know, and there's a lot of interest in him around the league at this point going into one more year before free agency. Do you look to see what you can get for him as far as big assets and maybe another player that could come back? I could still see Edmonton and Boston revisiting like a Lucic, Taylor Hall, a deal focused around those two players, that type of trade that they might be willing to do with other pieces involved as well. I think they're going to have some pretty significant roster players like that that they're going to talk about moving. And you know, that goes beyond like the coach Claude Julien, the GM Peter Chiarelli. Are they in trouble? Whose head rolls if they don't make the playoffs? Because I think there is going to be significant change as far as that stuff goes too, if they don't make the postseason.
Good stuff, Hags. Finally, Adam Proto of the Hockey News has come out against the idea of throwing hamburgers on the ice for Andrew Hammond. He is no, this is serious. I swear to God, I wish I was joking. He says that the Ottawa fans should instead donate their money to a local food bank. I'm sure Adam knows exactly where his local food bank is. Instead of throwing the burgers on the ice in a show of camaraderie and community and getting behind a team that they spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars on to watch play a child's game rather than donate that money to a food bank. What do you think about Adam's crusade to try to get Ottawa fans to donate their burger money to a food bank instead of throwing burgers on the ice?
I hope that Adam is getting plenty of clicks on that story as we speak, and I hope that it's cementing his status as the gadfly of hockey media.
When they build a statue to Adam Proto outside of the local food bank in Ottawa, do you think that they should have a small bag of burgers next to his foot, bronzed, or do you think that it would clash with him holding a giant soup canister and having that ladle in his hand, giving all of the soup to all of the poor people that come to the food bank that's now being funded by Ottawa fans' burger money?
I would put him in the Captain Morgan's pose with one knee up on a big pyramid of hamburgers, and he's kind of looking earnestly off into the horizon. What do you think about that?
Should the blue birds that fly around him like they did Snow White, do you think we should have one perched on his halo? Or do you think they should just kind of flutter around his head almost angelically?
You could have the birds and then have a little speaker at the base of the statue that's playing zippity-doo-dah all day long.
Every time somebody walks by, that's a brilliant idea. That would really attract more foot traffic. All right, listen. Thank you, Hags. I hope I didn't get you in trouble.
No, you didn't get me in trouble. Look, all I can say in this matter, Wish, is that I am pro-hamburger all the way. I am pro-tossing hamburgers on the ice. I think it's fun. I think it's an awesome story. If you don't like it, there are plenty of 99-cent hamburgers you can go donate to food bank.
Got 99-cent hamburgers, but, yeah, okay. All right, Hags, thank you so much, man.
You got it, buddy. See ya.
See, there's a difference between being a bleeding heart, like, Adam Proto and being someone who can be proactive about these things. Here's what Ottawa should do if they really wanted to kind of capitalize on this Andrew Hammond thing. I've seen this floating around on Twitter, so this is not an original idea. They have to somehow try to convince the NHL that it's okay to do the foam burger thing. I know the NHL frowned upon the rats, and I know the teams are like angry about the rats and they don't do the rats anymore, but it's the same principle. I mean, you know, if they were able to sell little foam burgers or something that people go throw on the ice at the end of the game, not during the game or after a goal or whatever, just they win the game and there's a stick salute and all the foam burgers come on the ice. Then you can collect them, you can resell them, it raises money for charity, yada, yada, yada. But the idea that, like, you know, you're not going to throw the burger on the ice because you're going to donate that $1.99 to the local food bank instead and you know, do you understand? I mean, do we all agree that this is community that's happening now, that this is organic, that this is a beautiful thing to watch a community come together around a frivolous sporting event? Like, that's why we have these things. That's why we spent taxpayer money on arenas, to let this thing happen, to all feel like we're in this big thing together. Jesus. All right, Jim Fox is an icon, and I'm sorry he had to stay on hold while he heard me rant for about 30 seconds. Just now to talk about the Los Angeles Kings. What's up, Foxy? How are you, man?
I'm doing fine. I've never done this before, but I'm walking through Central Park right now. So, and I'm talking on the radio. So that's a pretty good combination.
That is an awesome thing. I've seen more than a few. I'm here. I live in Manhattan. I've seen more than a few LA Kings swag around on people. We saw a hat before walking around before, and I have a feeling that the Kings may be represented quite well tonight at the Garden, which is a good thing because it's a pretty big game for them tonight. They took care of business in Jersey last night. They come out into the Garden to play arguably the best team in the East, maybe the best team in the NHL right now, in the Rangers. Talk to us a little bit about where the Kings are at this point in the season.
Well, it's way too early to say something like I'm going to say, but, you know, the Kings were able to win tonight. It'd be one of those you're in. You know, you win, you're in. And I know there'd be 9 games after that, but it's just one of those games that stands out because the way the Rangers are playing right now, I think you consider it bonus points. You're on the road. It's a back-to-back situation. But if you're able to get two, man, then that would just be one of those where you go, okay, now we are back in it and doing those types of things. So I talked to a lot of people last night. I've seen the Rangers, and they are on fire right now. They are playing so fast that it's difficult for other teams to keep up. So obviously the goal for the night, the Kings, is to slow them down and slow them down any way they can.
Yeah, the Rangers kind of remind me of the Blackhawks right now as being a team that seems to be able to play any style of hockey they need to play in order to beat their opponent. Like, they can change their style depending on who they play. I've seen them win the speed game, and I've also seen them just batten down the hatches and make the neutral zone quicksand against a team like Calgary, too. They're scary good. They're better than they were last year, I think.
You have to give Glenn Sather credit for the personnel, but in all honesty, and I said it on the air last night, we watched him for so many years when he was in Vancouver. I think Alain Vigneault is the most underrated coach in the entire league. I really believe that. I watched the Rangers in the finals last year against the Kings. I know the Kings 1-5, but their ability to get from point A to point B faster than anyone, and that's not just skating speed. That is understanding your system, and it's having no hesitation. That's all being on the same page. You combine that with the skill and the type of players that they have, and that's what they bring. And then that allows them, for the most part, to dictate the pace that the game's going to be played at. And when you're dictating, you're in control.
Yeah. You know, it seemed like the Kings were trying to do what the Kings do, which is to kind of bide their time until they have to put the pedal down and then really, you know, start just reeling off the wins and getting over the bubble and getting into a playoff spot. It just didn't seem like it was firing the way it should have. Was there anything you saw or any reason you can think of why they were unable to really turn it on like they've been able to in the last couple of years this year?
It's I'm going to go into a, it's almost like I'm going to contradict myself, but, you know, over the last 4 years, because of free agency, because of cap, the Kings have lost Rob Scuderi and Willie Mitchell. So those are defensemen, obviously. But when you look at the Kings, you say, you know, if their issue, anything, it would be the difficulty to score. So those are kind of, you know, they contradict each other. This year has been weird. The personnel back on defense has been a little bit younger, a little less experienced. Up front, when you look at the numbers for the top guys, and you know, you're talking world-class players. I'm going to single out two guys, but there's so many others. But for Andre Kopitar and Jeff Carter, under the Kings, their numbers are good. But unfortunately, so far what has happened, they've never been able to really do it in the same game. So, you know, one guy would carry the team for 2 weeks, the other guy would carry the team for 2 weeks, and it was difficult to get them both at the same time getting it going offensively. So, you know what, Greg? The Kings have played 3 bad games all year. I mean, I can go back and look at the games and say, you know, they've been fine. They've been in every game. They don't lay an egg. They don't. They rarely beat themselves. But at the same time, right now, you're looking on the outside, looking in for a playoff spot. So really weird situation. Top 10 in goals against. Basically have been there all year. So I think, you know, that's their identity. They're gonna hang with that. Yeah. They're gonna do it that way. And you know what? If God forbid it doesn't work, they're gonna stick with it. And that's the reason I respect them, because they're gonna be true to themselves, and they're gonna play that way.
I really want to make the case that Drew Doughty deserves the Norris Trophy. I think he's done some tremendous heavy lifting this year. The ice time, obviously, being what it is, playing extra time to try to make up for the losses on D. Where you've obviously seen Doughty every year he's been in the NHL. Where does this season rank amongst his seasons as far as, say, earning an honor like the Norris Trophy at the end of the year?
Yeah, there's been more dynamic seasons by Drew in the past, and unfortunately, probably because of where we play, he doesn't get the day-to-day, game-to-game credit that he deserves. Big moment player. I mean, he understands the game. Very rarely does he force himself upon a game where he's risky and trying too many things. At the same time, he's executing at a high level. And back to that word, dictating what's going on the ice. This year he's had to take on something he's never had to do before. And that is really kind of just, you know, he's probably had to manage his game more so because of the ice time he was expected to play. Injuries, inexperience back on the blue line, you know, personnel changes. And all of a sudden, he has to do more things than he did before. I think he has not failed at all in those. I think he's been right at the top. I know, and there's a few people that have mentioned in the past, I think that if the general managers voted for Norris Trophy, Drew Doughty would win it, because they get a chance to see him every night. They get a chance to analyze his game. They get a chance to figure out how important he is to the team. So if you're talking to me, he's got my vote.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to make a case for him, because I find it interesting that the case for Shea Weber seems so centered on the idea that it's his time, that he's due, that you know, there have been just like Doughty, performances in the past that may have been better than this season, but maybe it's time for him to get it. And all I can think of is, you could make the same case for Doughty, and maybe even a stronger case for Doughty, because I feel like he's been even more overlooked than Weber has.
You know, it's funny that you brought up Shea Weber's name, because in all honesty, I've talked to Drew about this. Drew Doughty is the biggest Shea Weber fan out there. I mean, he had a chance to play with him on the Olympic team. Of course, he gets a chance to play him in the Western Conference, and Drew absolutely loves Shea Weber's game. So I think you're talking about the elite of the elite, and that's something that, you know, both when you get at that level, you're able to respect what the other guy does. And, again, you know, if I were to go by team success and what the Kings have done, of course, this year, again, not necessarily as much in the past, but I think in the playoffs, what we see with Drew Doughty is this: as the games get more important and as the speed and tempo picks up, he gets better. And I think that's very difficult to do.
Yeah, well, I think he's just saying that because he knows that Weber can shoot the puck through him, through his body, like pass through his body. And I think that's a hell of a convincer right there, a hell of a convincer. Hey, so the Mike Richards recall was an interesting one. What were your thoughts when you saw Richie come back from the AHL?
I'll say this. I think that you have reasons as an organization, and, you know, cap issues and what type of production are you getting from a player that's taking up a big chunk of your cap. And those are probably general manager decisions, and that's the way it should be. Then you have coaching decisions. You know, who's the best player that's going to allow us to win 2 points tonight? And I think that's where, you know, if there's any discrepancy whatsoever, and both are viable. You know, people think that, you know, the GMs and the coaches are on the same page. Well, they're on the same page, yeah, when you come out of the room. But they both have, you know, they have different objectives. Of course, it's to win, but, you know, for the coach, it's wins now. And for the GM, it's kind of, you know, more of a long-term perspective. I think that Daryl Sutter just said, you know what, the younger kids that we have in the center position, even though we're talking about third and fourth line center, I'm not talking top two, they just were not putting up any type of numbers offensively to, you know, have a factor in the Kings' ability to go against what we were talking about earlier, which was that efficiency offensively. So, you know, I think you just go back and, you know, Daryl probably said, hey, we need wins now. That's obvious. They need every win to get into the playoffs. So here's our best chance. Even though last night he played under 12 minutes, so it's not like you would call him an impact player. I think Daryl Sutter feels that he needs the best available players to give him a chance to win 2 points, and that's why Mike Richards is here. And you know what? When the Kings won in 2012, no question in my mind that the difference maker, I'm not saying the best player, but the difference maker for the Kings was Mike Richards. The Kings have never seen a player like him, never seen that intensity, never seen the little things that he does. Now, his game, is dropped off the production, no question, but if he's going to play 12 minutes, I think for Daryl Sutter, he feels it's 12 minutes that are going to be positive as far as giving a chance for the team to get 2 points.
Yeah, and even though I disagree with the idea, I think ultimately the business decision needed to be made on his contract. I mean, what you just described is exactly why Dean kept him around. I mean, it's this loyalty to what he gave the team and this notion that he's a guy who will in those 12, 11 minutes be a complete gamer. So I get that. Last thing for you, Mr. Fox, and thank you for joining us during your lovely stroll through Central Park. Are they going to pull this thing out? I mean, you've got these pesky Flames that don't want to lose. You've got this Winnipeg team that all of a sudden is getting great goaltending from arguably the worst goaltender in the league. Minnesota looks solid. There's still other teams around the bubble, too. Are the Kings going to pull this thing out and make the playoffs, despite having to do a lot of heavy lifting on the road towards the end of the season?
Well, my perspective is probably different than your perspective or a lot of people listening's perspective. Yes. Yes, they're going to do it. Why wouldn't I believe they're going to do it? They were down 0-3 in the series last year, first series of the playoffs, and they came back to win. They went two of the last three Stanley Cups. It's very difficult from where I'm sitting to doubt that factor. Odds? Is it a huge challenge? Yes. When you look at those things and the schedule and the road games and the teams the Kings are playing, and that's back to maybe the first question, the Rangers. You know, if the Kings, I hate to say it, if Kings were to win tonight, I'd say they're in. It'd just be one of those games where you'd say, you know, they got the points and they proved it against one of the top teams in the league and those types of things. It's so tight. It's so close. But I cannot honestly in my heart doubt this team. They have just done so much and I can't doubt it.
There you go. All right, Jim Fox, ladies and gentlemen, awesome to speak to you, sir. Maybe I'll bump into you tonight at MSG. I'll be there covering the game. And it should be a fun one between two teams. One team that really would like to, I think, inflict harm on the other team in the Rangers' case, knowing that they got a chance to really make some hay in the West. All right, sir, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
There he goes. All these L.A. people getting a taste of New York early spring weather today. All right, winter weather. It's like still in the 30s, but whatever. I'm sure they're gamers. I'm sure they're all walking around with their personal portable heaters that they have outside of every restaurant in LA. Those big umbrella looking things that all have bubbling molten inside of them. I regret to inform everybody that I also have to build a soup kitchen statue in dedication to Nick Kiprios, friend of the show. Sportsnet's Nick Kiprios, apparently on Hockey Central today, and I can ask Merrick about that later. I think he was on Hockey Central today. Apparently on Hockey Central today, Nick Kiprios also suggested, as Adam Proto did, that the Ottawa fans donate the money they're spending on cheeseburgers that they're throwing on the ice to food kitchens and food banks. So we will have two statues. Kipper, I think his statue will be him beckoning the masses to the food bank with his massive pugilistic hand, so they will enter and be well fed. I just want to reiterate that the two people are saying that the $2 that people are spending on McDonald's cheeseburgers to throw on the ice in celebration of a goalie's victory have at no point in the last year said, instead of spending $800 to bring your family to a sporting event, take some of that money and give it to a food bank. At no point in the last year did they ever say, take the ticket money you're spending to watch a child's game for 3 hours and then spend more money at the child's game on beer and food and take that money and give it to charity. That was never said, but now it's $2 on a cheeseburger. Holy shit! Think of the poor people that have to go to the food bank. That, friends, is why we talk about hypocrisy on this show sometimes. Joining us now on the line is a man who does not know hypocrisy. It's not in his vocabulary, but he does now know the sweet, tickling love of the California sun. He is Josh Cooper of Puck Daddy, and he joins us here on the Merrick vs. Brzezinski podcast. Hello, Josh. How are you?
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
First time, long time? No, second time, long time. Maybe third time. Were you ever on as a member of the Tennessean?
I don't think so. Maybe once or twice, but it was probably to talk about Shea Weber. So because you know that's what I always talk about.
We just had Jim Fox on the voice of the Los Angeles Kings, and he told us that Drew Doughty's favorite defenseman in this league is Shea Weber, and I could read between the lines, and I get the sense that he's saying if Shea Weber was to beat out Drew Doughty for the Norris, that Drew would be okay with that, is what I think he's putting down.
Maybe, but again, it's sort of a matter of I've seen Shea Weber come this close to a Norris Trophy and somehow lose always. And I think it's a lot of reasons why. I mean, one is just the fact that it seems like his best years come in other guys' career, crazy best years. And his best years seem to come when these guys play for Canadian or bigger markets. So, or in the Nick Lidstrom example, you know, if a guy essentially hasn't had a great year, but his numbers look okay, and henceforth we must give him said award as a career achievement, or else it will be horrifying if he has less than, what, 7, 8, 9 Norris trophies in his career. So,
But hold on. Aren't we essentially making the same argument for Shea Weber now? Like, I think Weber and Doughty have the same argument right now. I think Doughty's had the better year, personally. I think Roman Yossi's had a better year than Weber has. But essentially the same argument is made for both of them, which is they're both all-world defensemen who have had to be bridesmaid to Nick Lidstrom, to Zdeno Chara, to Duncan Keith, and shouldn't we reward them for their biding of the time now with the Norris Trophy? I think Doughty and Weber, in some ways, the same argument's being made for both of them.
To some degree, yes, but I think with Drew Doughty, I've been able to see a few Kings games this year. I got to admit, I think he's actually having a better year than Shea Weber, and you see what Doughty does on the ice. I mean, he controls the pace of the game for so long, and Weber's a different style of defenseman. I mean, he's more of kind of the Rob Blake kind of or Scott Stevens, I'll hammer you and, hammer the puck. And he's a very loud player. He's a very intimidating player. But, I mean, when you want to look at guys who are all over the ice, I mean, Doughty's so good. I mean, you can't go wrong with either guy. I mean, I would be comfortable, for example, if Drew Doughty beat Shea Weber for the Norris Trophy. I could totally see that. But, I mean, for example, let's say if, like, Chris Letang beat him out, I'd be like, come on, really? Because that would be, yet again, another sort of Eastern Conference, East Coast. You know, we're going to give this guy the award because he has fantastic offensive numbers and a massive media machine behind him to push him for it. So, I mean, I'd be cool with Doughty winning it over Weber. I could see an argument for either player, but a guy like Letang or someone in the East, or like, for example, when Erik Karlsson beat out Shea Weber a bunch of years ago, I was like, come on, guys, really? And, you know, I just don't want to see another Eastern Conference guy get it. I want a Western Conference, West Coast, or small market guy to get it. So it's one of those two.
Yeah, and you know, I think there'll be more than a few small market people that are going to win awards this year. I think the Calder is an interesting race. Now, do you still favor Forsberg in that, or do you think that Goudreau or Ekblad have surpassed him for the Calder?
I've always favored Ekblad. I really just love the way that guy plays. Maybe I just really like defensemen. I don't know. But I really think that everyone uses the term man-child with him, but he's just a big guy. He's mature. He plays a lot of minutes. Now, granted, when you kind of look at his quality of competition, they do hide him against some matchups. But overall, as an 18- or 19-year-old, with how he's played, he's been phenomenal, and he's kept it up from a consistency standpoint. I think it's more of a two-horse race between him and Gaudreau, unless Forsberg can kind of reestablish himself. I think he's fallen off a little bit. That doesn't mean he's not going to be a great player, but I think that he's just not what he was earlier in the year. So I favor Ekblad over Gaudreau. I think Forsberg's out right now, but, I mean, if he goes on a big run at the end of the season, who knows? I mean, it's an entire year award, and we still have about 10 games left.
This is true. I think Goudreau's got that sort of, how do they say je ne sais quoi, to his game this year, where he's got some big moments. We all remember him trying to light a stick on fire, the whole thing. And if he finishes with the points lead, I think it's going to be really hard for anyone to make the argument that he's not the dude. Who do you see emerging as the Western Conference playoff teams, by the way, in that wacky mixed up bubble of ours? Do you think the Kings make the cut?
There's like, I don't know, 10 teams who I think can make the Stanley Cup final out of the Western Conference. It's hilarious because only 8 teams make it. So I really don't know. It's funny because I was talking with someone earlier today about this and just how the last team in, which could potentially be the LA Kings, could be the Western Conference favorite, which would be so funny on so many levels. I don't think the Kings are going to make it. I don't see them with the type of, or they're not going to make the Cup final if they make the playoffs. They don't have the type of depth that you need, I think, in order to go deep. I think the Ducks really do. I really like them. I think the fact that Rickard Rakell has really come on as a third-line center has helped a lot. I like the move they made at the trade deadline, getting bigger, more mobile on defense. And they're set for the playoffs. They have a good group. They do have guys who have won a Stanley Cup before, and Perry and Getzlaff. And I think that Ryan Kesler, his jerk factor goes up the bigger the game gets. And I like him on that team as a second line center. So I'm going to actually say the Ducks, which I think goes against my preseason prediction of the Kings. But Anaheim just looks so good right now. And I think that the only thing that can really screw it up for them is if Bruce Boudreau just keeps playing mind games with his goaltenders. Guy's got to make a choice at some point. He's got to make it sooner rather than later.
Indeed he does. How is California treating you? For those who don't know, Josh relocated to lovely Cali earlier. What, last week was it? Yeah, right?
Last week. Yeah, I got here, and the teams went to the East Coast to visit you. So I'm now here without two hockey teams, waiting for them to arrive. But it's supposed to, I mean, everyone here is worried that it's going to get up to 90 degrees this week. So I figure that everybody on Merrick vs. Wyshynski Nation should know that.
What is what's it like being in a market now where the games start at like 4 in the afternoon?
That I love. I'm not going to lie. It's kind of cool when it's like 6:30 and you're sitting there and it's like, oh, wow, game just ended and I'm about to start eating dinner. But I think one of the more interesting things to kind of go to a hockey perspective is I went to Kings Ducks last week, and I'll tell you, that was about as intense a thing I've seen from the state, I guess, from the crowd on down to the ice. It was, I mean, there were people who were really into it. Players were into it. I mean, I went to the Kings game on Saturday, and you do have some very old, interesting hamburger jerseys or walking around, or Burger King jerseys, whatever they call them, walking. I mean, people here care. People here like their teams, and there's certainly a history with both squads. And I mean, it's fun just to sort of see that now and see how much people are getting into this game, because I think that in California, they've started to realize, oh, wow, it doesn't have to be 3 degrees to play hockey. We can build a hockey rink anywhere. And it's like, and it's like, oh, and it's fun. And it keeps us in shape. And, you know, it's a great activity to do after we have our mochaccino. So.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess finally, your thoughts on the biggest news of the day, which is the return of the X-Files in a short miniseries probably this winter.
I wasn't a huge X-Files watcher, but
why?
I just wasn't. I don't know. It was just, I just never really got into it as a kid. But
is it because there was no rose ceremony on the X-Files, Josh?
Well, no, it was because it was like I'd be watching it, and like Mulder would like turn to Scully and be like, "I believe these are aliens," and Scully's like, "Yes, I believe they are," and I'm just sitting there and I'm like, "Well, duh." But, I mean,
she would never say it. She was the skeptic. You see, you don't even understand the dynamics of the show. She was the skeptic. If Mulder turned to her and said, "Scully, there are things in this world we don't understand, things that really baffle our scientific mind."
The bigger news is the fact that tonight I am going to sit down and watch the entire Tommy Wiseau miniseries, The Neighbors. So.
Oh, really? Oh, that's kind of fun. Where did you acquire such things? Did you get that from your friend Greg Sestero?
I don't kiss and tell, but I shall sit down and watch all 4 episodes, and it shall be glorious, because Tommy Wiseau is one of the most incredible accidental comedic minds of our generation.
For those who don't know, Tommy Wiseau is the vampiric, creepy lead of The Room, Josh's. I mean, I would call it your favorite movie, but I don't think that would necessarily do your obsession justice.
It's just an obsession, and we'll leave it at that.
And Josh, finally, your thoughts on the most important story of the day, which is the Ottawa Senators fans wasting away $2 upwards of $2.50 on hamburgers to throw on the ice during Andrew Hammond games. Sir, please, in the time we have remaining, condemn these people for not donating that money to a food bank instead.
Well, first and foremost, I would definitely donate that money to a food bank. Or if I'm McDonald's, just say, give us $2.50 to go to the Ronald McDonald House, and we'll give you this hamburger to throw on to the ice or something like that.
Yes.
That would be number one. Number two is, if your team does not make the playoffs because they have a high cholesterol count, it is all your fault. So, I mean, by doing this, they're contributing to their players' lack of healthy eating habits and henceforth mm-hmm. losses. So if they do not make the playoffs yeah. because of hamburgers being thrown on the ice and Curtis Lazar taking tons of bites out of them, it is all because of them.
Yeah, I respect you for your bravery, Josh. That was a stirring hot take on your part, and I hope that others heed your words and stop being so wasteful. And by that, I mean,
people.
Of course, not spending $800 to bring a family of four to a hockey game, which would be the wasteful thing that we should condemn. But no, it's the burgers. Josh, you're a gentleman and a scholar, and I'm so happy that you could join us here. Please enjoy whatever day part you are in California, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, take care, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. Josh Cooper of Puck Daddy, ladies and gentlemen, who is now based on the West Coast and will hopefully be doing a lot more late night games for us. So meanly he can sleep. Josh and Jen and Callie. Greg and Sean in New York. And that leaves out Chicago. Sorry, no coverage of the Blackhawks anymore. We're all Kings and Duckies and Rangers and Devils and Islanders. And the Sharks, occasionally. I actually got a little misty reading that the X-Files is coming back. I'm going to be honest with you. I was a huge X-Files fan. I don't know if we've talked about this on the show before. My dad and I went to an X-Files convention when I was a kid. X-Files t-shirts, X-Files books, X-Files mugs. X-Files, X-Files, X-Files. Until Duchovny left. And then I just didn't care about Agents Reyes and the other dude. And then the mythology got really twisted. And then they made that giant misstep, which is they followed a gigantic first movie, maybe not in gross box office gross, but at least in scope, with this desire to do sort of like a Monster of the Week follow-up movie, and it just didn't work. They had to go big again, and they didn't do it, and then the whole thing petered out. But 6-episode limited series, super excited, and hopefully it'll be awesome. And of course it'll be awesome. The X-Files. All right, that's the show. Start cutting it off. Nothing tomorrow, because tomorrow I am going to be en route to the Maury Povich show. Which is going to be awesome. And then Thursday, probably a show. And then we'll see about Friday. Who knows? Thanks to Jim Fox. Thanks to Joe Haggerty. Thanks to Josh Cooper. And we will talk to you soon. Bye.